into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Hello there, welcome along. It is the Huddle Breakdown. You know what we are about at this stage, and we've got a derby to sink our teeth into, so let's get straight into it. Juco James, hello.
Hello, Anda.
Twice in one day, is it, I don't know, is it a gift for us or is it a gift for the listeners? That's the question.
It's a nightmare. It's like Christmas and your birthday on the same day for you, but for everyone else, it's hell.
Alan Morrison is here as well. How are you getting on?
Yeah, all right, thanks. Good to see you both.
So, Celtic 1, Rangers 1, Moya El-Yunusi opens the scoring before Alfredo Morelos, the man who apparently owns Celtic Park, got his first ever goal there. Funny that. Scott Bain, Kenny, Welsh, Ayer, Laxalt, Brown, McGregor, Turnbull, Christie, El-Yunusi and Edouard made up the starting 11. And for the first 30 minutes, again, Celtic looked like the better side. And then after that, who knows what happens? Who knows what the fitness is like at Celtic Park at the minute for what happened? A couple of questions coming in on our Twitter account. Boy Analytics asks about Scott Bain's distribution. Paul Shaw wants to know about Celtic's stats decline from 60 minutes onwards. And Seltzer here asking about Laxalt's eye versus data and how that all works together. We are going to get into all of them because they are going to be what we're going to be touching on majority when we're talking about this game. So let's get straight into the breakdown then. Alan, where do you want to start with the actual match itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll start with a bit of a headline in that, you know, overall, it was actually such a sedate game. and how does the data kind of reflect that? Well, there was an amazing amount of what I call, you know, what I refer to as pack passing, which is, you know, taking opponents out with the ball. But the reason for that, you know, that might sound like some sort of German Bundesliga game where you've got two teams just constantly arrowing aggressive through balls through the lines, but it absolutely wasn't that. What it was two teams who actually committed a reasonable number of men into forward positions and were quite happy to have their first line broken permanently, but then were pretty compact after that. So actually, you know, in if you look at the packing nut data, on average, I think Celtic would complete around 60 passes, so forward passes that take people out of the game. They'd average about 60, and they actually averaged 103 in this game. And similarly, normally there would be 35 pack passes against Celtic, and in this game, the Rangers managed 61. So there's just a huge amount of players being taken out of the game, but it was always the same players. It was in the first half, especially, it was the Rangers front three that were pressing up as a three, and then it was the Celtic front three, with, if you add in Turnbull, to El-Yunusi. So on the face of it, like a really dynamic attacking game, but the reality, and that's just why you have to dig into the numbers a little bit, was the fact that, you know, there was very little aggressive pressing from the front, and the teams were happy to sit off each other from just before halfway back. Celtic absolutely had the best of the game. Made six saves. I mean, that's a pretty high number. If you think back to when we've spoken about Forster last season, and you think about the standout games that Forster had, he was up around the seven saves bracket in those Lazio games, and then against in the League Cup final. McGregor made six saves, and the post-shot expected goals of those was about 1.4, and he only conceded one. So, you know, he was by far and away their man of the match, absolutely. Just for that, none of the particularly, you know, it was an accumulation of shots. Some were particularly hard saves, to be fair. But we did rack up a reasonable expected goals. I just want to touch on expected goals. So, you know, looking at the data afterwards that came from James and others from Y Scout and places, it looked like it was broadly about 1.4 to 1.2, something of that ilk. So I had it at 1.5 to 0.7. I'm pretty sure the reason for that is that what Y Scout and others have done is counted as a shot when Roof tackled Christie in the 6 yard box, and the ball just dribbled past the post in the second half. Now I counted that as a tackle because Christie had possession of the ball, and Roof got his foot in, and the ball dribbled past the post. To me, that wasn't a shot. So by discounting that, and that shot was in that moment was in the 6 yard box. Mm-hmm. I think that explains the disparity really. So you know, with a single game XG of 1.7, Celtic really should be kind of winning that game, to be honest. Again, we didn't, and I think it was probably a debate to be had about the Rangers' approach in terms of, you know, were they actually, again, like they were at New Year, content to start with a point and end with a point, and if they got anything along the way, that was a bonus. I think, actually, the way the game panned out, especially how they dropped into a very rigid 4-4-2 after half-time, whereas previously in the first half they'd pushed up with three players, they took a striker off quite early in the second half and pushed Kent up and actually played a very compact and very narrow 4-4-2 for most of the second half. And I think we're just content to take the chances on the break if they got them. Having said that, to the point some people on Twitter, again, if you look at the last three attempts at goal in the game, they were in the sort of 80th minute onwards, 84th minute onwards, they were all from the Rangers, two of them from corners. And Celtic didn't really have an effort after the 82nd minute and didn't have that many after half-time. At half-time, Celtic were in a very strong position. And they tired, potentially, but also Rangers were constantly refreshing their team during that second half. Whereas Celtic, Kennedy sat on his subs and barely used them, and certainly used them in a very odd way.
Mm-hmm. That has been a theme of Celtic season under Neil Lennon and under John Kennedy as well, the bizarre substitutions that don't really seem to make sense. It's probably fundamentally comes down to the lack of depth in the squad and the amount of the players that we have in positions. James, your general thoughts on the game?
I think Alan's point on the Roof event, I'll call it, because it's debatable as far as how to classify that, really highlights the importance of making a distinction between data and analytics, and how metrics need to be interpreted. So, you know, it really depends on what question you're trying to answer, right? So I would argue that the fact that ball came in the way it did in that area, it's a pretty threatening sequence of play, even though it didn't really register anything of consequence.
It was from a shot, though. Sorry, James. The ball came in and a Rangers player headed it. Christie actually blocked the shot, so they got credit for that.
Right.
And then he recovered the ball. Right. So he actually recovered his own block, and then Roof slid in and took the ball off him. Yeah.
Right, and I totally get it and agree. I would probably argue that, you know, the chance was overstated by what most of the XG models were. Yeah. You know, I think Instat had it high. Y-Scout certainly did. I think, but the flip side of that is there was a ball into Morelos earlier in the game inside the box in an incredible threatening area, where he misplayed it and had a bad touch, where if he had controlled it, I mean, that may have been the best scoring opportunity of the game.
If he's a good player, he'd have controlled it, right?
Well, you're right. No, I get that. But again, it comes back to this idea of, you know, XG is just one metric. So this is why I came away from the game thinking about this in a couple of different ways that I think's, you know, probably different than a lot of people. So I think of it within the context of the January 2nd game. And when I look at that comparison at a high level, the XG differential that you probably have, Alan, was probably pretty similar between the two games. But if you look at, for example, Rangers PPDA for it and compare passes per defensive action. So, you know, what was the intensity of pressing in this game? That's why, you know, people kind of came away from this game as a lot of talk as far as like a glorified friendly. You know, it was like a dead rubber friendly-esque, not a lot of energy. I mean, Y-Scout had their PPDA at 22 for this game, whereas it was both teams were at eight, a little over eight in the January 2nd game. So that's why it definitely felt to me as if, or looked to me watching it, that Rangers were really never out of first gear for the most part. They weren't really pressing. I'm a big believer and fan of attribution. So this is not my original thought. This was actually from Christian Wolf at the Cynic. He looked at the data at the game and really commented about Morelis's pressing pretty clearly being engineered to deny Iyer the ball and build up play.
No, that's right.
Yeah, and
it wasn't pressing. He didn't press him. He just literally stood in his space. That was it.
He was blocking the passing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. So again, it was almost like a soft trap in midfield from if you had tired players rather than, you know, an aggressive in your face press. So they were quite pleased just to leave Brown and Welsh on the ball, I think, and just kind of sit back and not do that much. So I think they were fine with a draw. Mm. I think that the other metric that to me, the two metrics, and it was tilted to the second half again, we keep coming back to the same theme, was, you know, if you look at entries into our box versus their box and you compare it to the game on January, there is no comparison. I mean, they had a lot more possession and kind of, just time with the ball around our box in this game than they did in January. And that was with us being down a man for a half an hour. So just the raw numbers. I mean, entries into our box was 24 this past week versus 13 in January.
Yeah.
And they touched the ball 25 times versus 14 in January. So again, they didn't do as much with it this time either. But as far as kind of just control of the game, you know, relative dominance and control of the game was better on January 2nd. It's kind of the moral of my story, because it was a more motivated, Rangers team. And, you know, we played a game, a man down for a half hour. You know, in this game with them not really going to all that much effort or pressing us kind of in cruise control, you know, we didn't really do that much with them in that state of play. So that's kind of how
James,
I came away from it.
Yeah, James, sorry. I just, like, on that point, I'd kind of disagree, because I think it's more stylistic, actually, more than an indication of threat. So you're right. I had possession in the box at 25 for them, 16 for us. You look at that and you think, whoa, you know, that doesn't tally. And it actually is out of kilter with all the other metrics on the game. But I think it's more of a stylistic thing. And if you look at the way that they play, and one of those occasions was actually five consecutive passes within the edge mm-hmm. of the 18-yard box,
yeah, in the first right side half. That one sequence, yeah,
because they're settled into this way of playing whereby it's incredibly patient, and if you notice the number of times they recycle the ball, they'll get the ball out wide and then they recycle it again. There's none of this just launching it into the box. There's none of this speculative pass or even very early cross of any nature into the box. They'll wait till they get into a position where someone's got time to cross, and then they'll cross it. It's just, I think it's more of a, it speaks more to their style than the fact that they were particularly threatening in the Celtic box. Most of that possession was in the corners of the box as the ball was recycled in and out again, I would say.
Right. And I my only point is that I think that our pressing and counter pressing in January gave them a lot of fits, kind of like what Slavia Prague did in their tie, where when this was kind of what I wrote after Rangers. I did a thread on the Rangers game. It's kind of a lead into the Derby and against Prague. And, you know, they really had trouble with, particularly in the first game, with Prague's pressing. And it very much echoed what we did against them on January 2nd. So I agree with you. My point is that possession and that style of play that they had was probably up about 30 yards on average. There was more of it closer to our goal you know, it's almost like a real estate issue. If you were thinking about, you know, two armies, the battle was more on our side of the pitch and closer to our final third, defensively than towards their end, you know? So does that really matter? I mean, not really, because again, it was a dead rubber. And my point is really that we're probably not going to face them with the conditions being riper for us to have a more controlled, dominant performance than we went into that, you know, relative to this season anyway. And, you know, the fact that we didn't do a little more with it, I think is a little disappointing. I rewatched the game Sunday night, and because again, I'm a total dork and have no life. And you know, I misremembered, you know, my feeling watching the game live was not supported by my rewatch, meaning that I had this sense coming out of the game. I was like, wow, we really, you know, the way we went down the left side and the problems we were giving them with Elyounoussi and Edouard out wide left, I felt like it was most of the first half coming out of the game. And then on my rewatch, it was about 8 minutes, maybe 10 in kind of in that 25 to 35 minute range. Otherwise, that first half, there wasn't much in it either.
That's a good point, actually. I've just finished capturing the data not that long ago, and you're right. The abiding memory of that first half was that Balogun was just getting pulled all over the place. But actually, he might have got beaten a couple of times, but it wasn't that big a deal. But listen, you know, it comes back to the fact that with Celtic one goal up, if they then get a penalty and go 2-0 up, that completely subverts everything that we're just talking about. It's completely subverted. It's a completely different game of football, and you can't. I think it's right to bring it up because, you know, I looked at Colum's performance actually throughout the game, because it was one where you actually had to take notes to say that's another decision, and you know, literally there were 12 decisions throughout the game that Colum gave against Celtic. And you can see from the reaction of players, they're going, sometimes, you know, if a foul's committed, Brown had a couple, you know, and he runs back, not wanting to make a fuss about it because he knows it's a foul. But when the players are looking at each other and going like this to the referee, it's usually because, what are you doing? And 12 occasions, and these were all either breaking up play, you know, McGregor getting tripped near the corner flag in the first half, you know, Barisic giving the play there and running into Kenny, but then a foul being given against him. You know, breaking very early in the game, getting clipped in the ankles, no foul, the non-penalty decision, which was incredible, and on and on it goes. There was even one, and to be honest, this was probably, I'm sure it was unintentional, where actually Colum ran and blocked Brown from you know, defending a break right very late in the game, which was very unusual actually. So you know, the decisions just go on and on. And as I say, you know, we're here to be balanced. We're here to focus on data. But I think, you know, we all know the context that Scottish football is played, and refereeing is one of those things where, you know, there is a lack of transparency. There's a lack of accountability. Those that select the refs also train them. They also, you know, say which games are going to do. They evaluate them, and then they decide, you know, which semi-finals, finals, and who gets nominated to go to European competition. So we all know that there's no transparency in all of that. I don't feel we're not being true to our ethos by bringing that up.
Yeah, no. I want to go back to the penalty incident, because I want to talk to you about that. But before I get into that, I did a thread last week on, because, you know, there's all this talk about cult teams, maybe introducing cult teams in the pyramid in Scotland. So just out of curiosity, I went and did some benchmarking and looked at officiating and just simple, you know, yellow cards and fouls and kind of ratios in other leagues. And it was interesting because there's a very consistent relationship in other pyramids and other countries where, quite commonsensically, lower leagues have higher fouling rates. You know, so if you go into the fourth division of Italy and then the third division and then the second division and then the top division, there's a, you know, a the number of fouls called per game starts like at 16 and then it goes down until he gets up to, you know, Serie A, and the rate is lower. And then, you know, there's kind of a consistent relationship relative to yellow cards as well. And if you look at Liefering, for example, in Austria relative to Salzburg, you know, so there's this logical sequence in Germany and France. And then when you get to the UK, in Scotland and in England, if you go down to the lower leagues, they don't call as many fouls. So, and this is at the top flight too. I mean, it's just officiated differently. And, yeah, and my argument was, you know, do we want to be sending our talented youngsters into League Two in Scotland, where they are only calling like 10 fouls a game, and their yellow card issuance is about 30% lower than comparable leagues in Europe? So we're going to send an 18-year-old kid up into the Highlands to get butchered, when we're trying to get him trained up so he can play in Europe, in the Champions League. You know, you made me think of that, Alan, because of I think the officiating issue in Scotland is systemic, and it's probably in England as well. I mean, the National League in England has the same issue. I mean, just, you know, very low levels of foul calling and yellow card issuance relative.
Yeah, but James, if Colin was incompetent, right, he would call 6 bad calls for Celtic and 6 bad calls for the Rangers. If he's making 12 bad calls against one team.
Yeah, is that
incompetence?
Yeah,
what does your analytical brain say?
Yeah, I don't disagree that there's probably unconscious bias to a degree that takes place in all officiating, but there is a level of sequencing and variance that would take place. So it's not outside the bounds that could happen in one game and tilted one direction. I take your point. I take your point. I haven't done it. I'd have to go back and look at a long-term sample of his officiating of each team and do that kind of thing. But I take your point. I'm not arguing with you at all. I think there's a bigger conversation about officiating quality and culture to be had in the UK relative to youth development. I think that's a bit, you know, that's kind of what I'm getting at, and whether or not Celtics should strategically be looking to expose young talent to that environment, and whether that's productive for you know, the business plan, so to speak.
The standard in the UK of refereeing is terrible, and I think that's why we're seeing more issues with controversy and VAR in the Premier League as we are in the European leagues, because the standard of, you can give a bad referee 4 replays, he's still going to get the decision wrong because he's a bad referee. So you need to train these guys up, and the Scottish referees' reign standards have always been terrible, and there's always been an issue. I just don't think that it played as big a role in this game as maybe it could have and has done in previous games. But in terms of the Colts, like the difference in the thinking behind putting the Colts in there is that even though you do expose them to this sort of rough and tumble of that, at least you're doing it in your own controlled environment of the Colts are playing your brand of football, instead of sending the likes of Karamenko, Dembele down to someone like, I don't know, like Stevenage, who are kicking the ball along. He's not getting a touch and he's still getting kicked out. He's still getting kicked. He's still getting fouled. So I think that's the idea around that. In terms of the game, so let's get back to the game.
Let me ask if I could ask my question on the penalty real quick.
Okay, go for it.
Because I've had this debate, and I come at this from a posture of ignorance, meaning that I do not have any background in officiating football matches at all. I certainly haven't read the rule book relative to, how to enforce whether or not that was a penalty or not. I get that I've read and listened to some officials that have talked about it, or ex-officials, and it seems like the two big variables in this is, how do you subjectively characterize whether or not Barisic was wild or reckless in coming into the challenge, which again is subjective. There's no way to objectively say whether he was or not. That's going to be an interpretive issue, because that seems to be the linchpin as to whether or not there should have been a penalty. Is that right, Alan? Is that how you would think about it? Because
I mean, again, the action of the referee was very telling, because you come down to, was there contact, and is that contact sufficient to cause a player to go down and for it to be serious enough to award the penalty? So I mean, irrefutably, there is contact. Okay, now Colin must be able to see that contact. All the players on the pitch could see there was contact. Barisic knew there was contact. You could tell by the look on his face. Therefore, what Colin could have done is say, "Well, I think there's a bit of contact there, but I'm not. I don't think it was sufficient for Edouard to go down. Therefore, we'll let Wave play on." But he didn't. He stopped the game and he booked Edouard for diving, which means his unconscious or conscious bias was never going to give that penalty for Celtic. And in fact, right. you know, how dare you even ask for one? Really? Yeah. That. If he'd said, look, it wasn't, because there wasn't like he dislocated his knee or anything. There wasn't a huge amount of contact, but there was contact. And if he'd said, look, I don't think that was enough for a penalty, I wouldn't have accepted that. But at least he's made a judgment. I think coming from a non-biased perspective, but to actually book Edouard, given that he knows there's contact for diving, I think is extraordinary.
I have a, because I got the sense, again, just from a raw, having seen it, and then I watched it back a few times from the different angles. I mean, I didn't have a strong inclination that it was a penalty. I agree with you. The booking of Edouard was egregious. But I think it's also instructive that Celtic decided not to appeal it, because relative to that interpretive part of it, meaning that I think of that back to Enda's point about VAR, having been through video review in sports for a long time now in the NFL, and, it's common that these things are screwed up pretty regularly. And, it's always this, definitive visual evidence, that kind of thing. And I have to say, having watched that, but I mean, I agree with you interpretively, the way people responded, that it did look like he probably touched him. Again, whether it was a foul or not, I think is another debatable question, but I sure as hell could not see it, like, without a reasonable doubt. Like, if you go back to the a Yeti card that got overturned, like, you could literally see his foot flopping after the contact. So you could reasonably say, okay, there was definitely visual evidence of contact here. And, so I doubt that even in a VAR situation, that they could have, without any kind of irrefutable evidence, said he definitely touched him there. Cause I couldn't see it. And I was watching it 20 different ways. And he probably did, but you can't infer. That's the problem.
So where people, I think, when watching football, often, make mistake, I feel personally, is that if you've played the game, it doesn't, especially if you're turning at speed or doing any action quickly, it doesn't actually take a lot of a contact to make you go down. Edouard had no reason to go down at that point. He'd cut back in. Barisic was committed to the slide. He was 7 yards from goal. He really wouldn't have been in his mind at that split second that was the best option. But having felt the contact, I'm sure he didn't stop himself falling over. But it doesn't take a lot of contact to make somebody go down at that pace. It really doesn't.
But I think you touched on something important there, because I don't like these conversations when we're talking about whether or not it was a penalty, because it wasn't given. So it doesn't really matter overall. My main question, like my instinct looking back at it, was why didn't Edouard shoot? So a more important question, I think, to ask is, to the best of your knowledge, because I know you don't actually have it, but what XG would Edouard have had there if he does not go down?
Yeah, you're looking at sort of around, 0.5 or something of that nature.
Pretty good chance of scoring.
Pretty good chance.
That's a very high quality, I think the question becomes one of, and it's, it's always tough to criticize a player that makes a snap judgment in that kind of situation, because there was a defender flying in, not even Barisic, but there was another defender coming from the other direction. So, with hindsight, in an ideal world, would he have taken that without an extra touch? Maybe, but that very possibly could have got blocked too. I mean, he would have had to have been pretty precise in his placement to avoid hitting a defender and putting it in a location where McGregor wasn't going to save it. So again, it probably a very high pre-shot XG with it actually being a goal, maybe not as likely as that might reflect
XG models. I think most players are going down, really.
Oh,
most, they're told to go down, so most of them are going to go down. Rangers, if that was Morelos in the same position, he's going down. So
he would act like he was shot.
Yeah, I personally think Edouard should have shot. But let's move on because it wasn't given another penalty. So, in terms of do we want to start negative or do we want to start positive? Where do we want to go? Do we want to go with the duffer or do we want to go with the boy?
At halftime, there was a question asked about Laxalt. So at halftime, he had a really good half. Second half was classic Laxalt. His passing was 15 completed, 9 uncompleted. He had 3 crosses which were missed. In terms of being packed, Kenny was only taken out times, Laxalt 9. So again, there were occasions when, on the rare occasions when they did break, it was generally down that left side. So he kind of got dismissed from my boy of the match for the second half performances. I would say of the others, predictably both Ayer, whose transaction success rate was 88%, and McGregor, 3 secondary assists, 1 key pass, and the highest passing stats of any of the midfielders were the usual kind of, 7 out of 10 at least, if you want to put it that way. Turner had created 3 chances, but they were all from set plays. Nothing much from open play again, which is becoming a theme. I actually would agree with on Celtic TV, Elyounoussi was given the boy of the match, and I would agree with that mainly because he had the greatest scoring threats. He had 6 scoring threats. That's goals and assists combined, 0.96. And obviously, he scored the goal as well. So on that basis, he won the match.
Yeah, I would echo generally the comments, Alan Mayo. I think we're generally in agreement on the overarching conversation. I'm going to go with Edouard, and I know it might be a little bit, I'll give you my rationale. One is that we saw a return to some creativity from him, which has been lacking this season to a large degree. So we had that flash post-break last season where he was creating a lot of chances for Griffiths and others. So that cross was just a really great sequence of play. It was, I tweeted about this during the game. I think Kennedy should get some credit because it looked like a coherent strategy as far as how Edouard and Elyounoussi were playing together, much more so in the first half than we've seen with Elyounoussi playing in any kind of two-striker system in any other game. So there were times, significant periods of play where Edouard was down the right wing. I couldn't even believe it. It was like, I thought I had to rub my eyes.
It was weird.
Yeah. I was like, what's he doing there? So the relative spacing between them, they were interchanging. Both of them were getting wide at times. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why we remember so much of the Balogun exposure was that, we were getting people and interchanging them out wide where they normally don't. They hadn't been in prior games when they played together in a two-striker system. So I think that was very positive, and I think Kennedy should probably get some credit for that. But, I also, again, Alan's data might be a little different, but I referenced this on Twitter. I believe that was Edouard's highest combined XA and XG versus Rangers, other than, I think, the 5-0 game that he was in early. And again, that was, I think that was pre-Girard, and that was also, against the Rangers side that had a lot of really bad players in it relative to the team on the weekend. So, would have been nice had he executed that goal and or gotten the penalty. But I think, for him to be over 0.4 in XG and I think 0.2 some and have the assist, and that, to me, that was one of our best goals of the season. I think that was the way that the play unfolded and the quality of the cross and Elyounoussi's finishing on that was just tremendous. So I'll give it to my boy of the match, to Edouard.
I'm worried that because the Scott Brown news has just broken, that he's the duffer of the match. I thought he was all right. In terms of
not for me.
My standout worst performers, I think it has to go to Ryan Christie. I don't know if I'm being unfair there, because obviously I don't have, I see I'm in the weakest position when it comes to this podcast, because I'm doing this solely off my eye and what I'm seeing. So, and I, to be fair, I can barely remember the second half. It passed you by so easily. But yeah, I just stands out as someone who didn't do much.
So Chris had a very Christie game in some respects and not in others. So let me explain that a little bit more. Very interesting that you say that. Okay, he had seven successful challenges. He won the ball up his own defensive third four times, which is more than any other player. Okay, so in terms of diligence, defensive, he had the highest defensive action success rate of any of the midfield players. He, as I say, he had the highest number of recoveries of any of the midfield players. He won the ball back, as I said, four times in his own half. So that's all positive. He barely gave the ball away. I didn't do any stupid shots outside the box. So there's that. The flip side of it is, you know, Christie's game is built on, you know, on taking risks. But having said all that, a relatively subdued and non-risk-taking Christie still created two chances, right? I mean, Turnbull created three from set pieces, but from open play, Christie and Elyounoussi both created two. So he was still up there.
Well, he also had that one terrific kind of combo through ball cross. Yeah, that didn't quite come off. Well, even above and beyond that one, Alan, it was that there was a cross to Elyounoussi where Elyounoussi made a run down in the left half space, and it was just a beautiful ball. And he just didn't quite, you know, first touch was a little off, and I think it went out for a corner. He didn't get a shot off. But that was terrific, that pass.
So a quiet Christie still had the highest expected scoring contribution of any of the players out of the strikers. So that's a poor Ryan Christie performance. I'll take it.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of confirmation bias set on with Christie because, you know, because of the shooting problems earlier in the season, and because at times he does. You know, he takes chances, as Alan says. So, you know, if you're already biased to see his warts in his game, then every time he has a pass go awry, it feels exponentially worse. And it's out of context as far as what his overall kind of performance levels are. So that's a perfect example, I think, of because I agree with you. And when I was watching the game, he was driving me nuts. But again, I think it's because a lot of us have been conditioned to feel that way towards him.
So that's why I capture all the data, not just the glory stuff, the nitty-gritty stuff as well.
Exactly.
that makes a performance. It makes a 90-minute performance, right?
Somebody's got to do the dirty work. Exactly. Yep.
So who's your duffer then? Who stood out as a sort of underperformer then?
For me, it would be Kenny, right? Not just for that horrendously clumsy back pass that in the corner that resulted in the goal.
I mean, you could have put that anywhere. You could have put that anywhere other than out for a corner.
Okay, so listen, he had the receiving impact score is the score of you're the receiver of a forward pass that's taking players out of the game. So someone spotted you, you've got into space, and you've received a forward pass. Players are now out of the game, and it's good. He received 29 passes, took players out of the game during the match, which is incredibly high, and more than any other Celtic player. He had the highest, the two fullbacks had impact scores of 144 and 150. 144 and 150, the two fullbacks. Basically let the fullbacks have the ball, knowing that they were going to do absolutely nothing with it. So Kenny was in great positions with players out the game, time and time, 29 occasions. He's got zero expected assists, absolutely zero. Nothing, created nothing from that great possession and time. And the fact that they were playing so narrow, they were just letting the fullbacks have the ball, and he created nothing. I know he had one shot from outside the box with his left foot, which was a bit of a sort of, you know, loose moment in the game, and that was it. And I think this game, you know, there is that cliche with players that play in the Celtic against, you know, the Derby games, that, you know, is where you can judge in some respects. And I don't think he did that well, unfortunately. There were other, for me, my summary of Kenny, and this is not really rooted in data, this isn't very much the eye test, is he just looks very ponderous. He just takes too long to make decisions about what he's going to do with the ball. He's just physically, I don't think he's physically particularly slow. He just takes that fraction of a second too long to make a decision about what he's going to do. And he can, and maybe that comes out in lack of creativity, in spite of the fact he had so much of the ball. Mm-hmm. And he really didn't create anything because he just doesn't see, or whether he doesn't see, or whether he just doesn't react quick enough to find that next pass, I don't know. But for me, yeah, he was my duffer.
Yeah, sometimes I feel, and I've noticed this watching Ireland quite a bit, and even Manchester United to a degree as well, when the pass is on, if the player in himself doesn't have the ability, or doesn't have the he doesn't feel that he has the ability to make that pass through the line and break the line, they generally won't make it. And the like, so that's so clearly obvious with Fred playing for Manchester United at the minute. He will always take the option to go back, even when there's an option to break the line to the fullback. He doesn't have the passing range to do it. And I'd worry that that's probably the reason that Kenny doesn't do it as well. James, is Kenny yours as well? This is where it comes in. I want to revise my duffer and make it Kenny now.
No, too late.
You're allowed to change your mind.
No, see, I'm going to say no. That's what makes this show. We're trying to expose why the eye test doesn't always work.
And well, I have the power of editing this, so I can do what I want.
Brilliant.
Are you a deep fake? Do we even know if this is Enda? Mine was also Kenny. I think, you know, it's the same MO that we've had with Laxalt, which is probably just a misfit with Celtic style of play, what we need out of our fullbacks. You know, he probably would be suited for the late Lustig role as a, you know, more of a back three, pseudo back three with Tierney bombing on. Oh, the glory days. So, you know, he seems to be relatively proficient in defending. I mean,
he is.
Yeah. I mean, he seems like he's a fairly disciplined positionally and that kind of thing. The other thing I wanted to bring up, because obviously he was culpable along with Brown losing Balogun on the corner. And my latest theory to contribute to the debacle that has been set pieces, other than we're just too small that we've talked about regularly, is I wonder how much guys like Laxalt and Kenny have been part of the defending setup in marking men in their careers, meaning that, you know, through Milan and through Schalke, because traditionally, you know, usually fullbacks are the guys out, you know, playing kind of outside the box.
Or on the post.
You know, given our size deficit, I mean, we've got two fullbacks who are two of our bigger, taller guys, I guess, that we're throwing to mark guys, strikers, players, you know, the other team strikers. And I wonder how much these guys have organically had that in their development and their careers, and how much of it they've just been thrown in to do this. And it's like, well, of course they don't look like they know what they're doing because they haven't done it that much in their career. So that was the only other thing I thought might be somewhat insightful.
Yeah, but see, James, I've been listening to pundits for 30 years tell me that if you man-to-man mark at corners, you don't concede any goals. I thought man-to-man marking was the magic formula that stopped you conceding goals at set plays. I think having loads of guys that are about 5'7" probably has something to do with it as well. Perhaps.
Well, because of the, you know, I haven't been a set piece analyst by any stretch of the imagination, but I have started to notice, because of the debacle that has unfolded this season with Celtic, I take notice of how other teams approach some things. And it's very interesting. If you watch Davis for Rangers, he lines up as if he's defending zonally. And then depending on where the ball is kicked, he reads the aerial flight of the ball. And then if it's not going to be in his direct zones, he immediately goes to the front post and marks the post. So in some ways, it's a hybrid approach, meaning that you hear people say, well, you don't put people on the post because it's better marking you know, the ball. This is almost like a mixture of those two, where he has that kind of zonal responsibility. If the ball looks like it's coming his direction, and then if it's not, he very quickly gets on that post. And you're, I mean, I'm sure you remember, guys, that I think he was two Julian shots that he knocked off of the post in, I think it was the December 29th defeat when we lost to them. Where he just, you know, was on the post. And then, you know, you get people that automatically revert back to their bias. You know, you get the throwback crew that says, why the hell don't we have guys on posts? And then you have people say, well, statistically, it's better if you, you know, have people off of the posts. And I'm like, well, this is a really interesting way that seems like it's both.
I personally think just stick a man on the back post. You don't really... It's like you don't really need a guy on the front post, to be honest, because generally you're covering the zone anyway. But I just think it's a no-brainer for me to stick a man on the back post, because that's majority of the time where you see the ball going in from a corner. But again, if you stick John Joe Kenny on the post, I mean, he's what, 5'8"? So if it's a good header, it's probably going over his head. So that's where you're getting the issues. Do we have a stat of the day before we finish up?
You have one, Alan? If not, cool. I got one.
Go on, go for it.
Yeah, mine was that PPDA differential.
Can you just explain what PPDA is?
Yeah, so it's passes per defensive action. So okay, to me, that's the stat of the day because it really describes how much this was like a friendly in many respects. So the level of intensity and energy just wasn't there. And I, to me, that was disappointing. I mean, Celtics was, you know, 10.5. But so that was in the neighborhood of being okay. But, you know, like I said, I was disappointed with how much the game just kind of lacked what maybe a lot of us had hoped going in, which is it would be a more exciting derby and, you know.
Yeah. Fans in the stadium makes the difference in these type of games that don't really matter. Like there's no way that it would have been as lackadaisical in the second half if there was 60,000 people in the stadium. I refuse to believe that, even if the league was gone. Since there's no big news happening with Celtic these days. There's no big names that haven't managed in 10 years being linked with a job. I think it's time to finish up this podcast. We might, if Celtic do manage to appoint the guy that was linked with the job, I just can't get it out of my head. I can't believe that. I just can't believe there's a guy who hasn't managed in a decade, and even when he was managing a relegation candidate championship side, and he's the favorite for the job. It's baffling.
Yes.
I know you don't have an idea.
It is baffling.
It's baffling. So we might touch on that if he gets the job, and we'll all say a prayer in between that he doesn't actually get the job, because God almighty, we need our sanity at some point. The split is happening next time we are talking to you. It will be the final couple of games of the season, and we do have the Scottish Cup against Falkirk to
yes, my hometown team.
Yeah, oh, nice one. Well, hopefully we don't go the same way as Hearts and lose to a team that haven't played since Christmas.
you know what? I don't know if that game isn't going to get covered. It hasn't shown up in Y Scout yet. So I've been looking diligently because I've been curious to see what the backdrop of that game was, because I didn't get to see it. But
because they are doing the Scottish lower leagues now, aren't they, on Y Scout?
Yeah, it was an early cup game. So I don't know when they pick up the cups.
It's not so good on cups, is it? They don't do League Cup, do they?
They do. They picked up the League Cup, but again, that doesn't have as many early rounds. So, but yeah, the joke I came out of is through the the 6 degrees of Neil Lennon. Does that mean that we could lose to a team of Brorar if they make it deeper in? Would they be a threat to us? Because we almost lost that Hearts team in December. So.
Well, listen, everyone just say a wee prayer to the God that doesn't exist, and hopefully we'll come away with this as in a little bit better condition than Hearts went in to that Scottish Cup. So if you want to listen back to this podcast, you can get it on Spotify, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcast, really. You can get us on Twitter as well, at Hollow Breakdown. And if you do believe in God, I apologize for saying he doesn't exist. He does exist to you, and that's okay. So we'll chat to you later.